Well, Nathan, I'm going to break format a little bit, tell you, keep that song up there a little bit in the background for the sadness tonight of the loss of Clarence Clemons, the big man, you know, a seminal member of the E Street Band. Keep that music high up there for a second, because he's going to blow here in just a second. Unfortunately, dying from the complications of a stroke. Clarence Clemons, he really did. He made a huge contribution to pop music. It wasn't just the fact that he was with Springsteen. He changed the way people played saxophone. Turn it up here. And there's so many Clarence Clemons impersonators out there. So many people took that style and copped it. And it was such a, it was unique. It was cool. And he was great. And I just saw him in concert about a year ago. And he was, well, you know, he was the big man. And it's hard to imagine the E Street Band without him. And yet somewhere up there, I'd like to think God is saying, blow, big man, blow. So we'll play a couple of Springsteen cuts throughout the night tonight, along with some others, as we get into Sex, Murder, and the Meaning of Life. Douglas Kendrick coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. Well, Dr. Douglas Kendrick, I've really enjoyed Sex, Murder, and the Meaning of Life. I've learned a lot about life by the study of the brain, and this is no exception. Highly recommend this. I've had this book around here for a while. As you may remember, Dr. Kendrick, we were actually going to have you on right when the book came out, but it came out right about the time we'd had about five other brain scientists on the show. So I didn't want you to get lost in the shuffle, not to mention the fact that it's an endlessly fascinating topic. So I knew it would wait a little bit, but that should go to show you how many shows we do here on Coast to Coast and how we are fascinated by brain mapping and the things we're learning of what's going on inside of our heads and inside of the heads of people who are doing very unusual things in the world. So thank you for waiting a couple of weeks to come on with us on Coast to Coast.
No problem.
And in fact, I mean, I think the idea of murder and the brain and the things that we do, the dark side that exists in us, I think this is something which it still hasn't quite been worked out yet. And so I really like the way you're advancing the research and the stories that you tell, both about your own life and about the things that you've been exploring. So let's start with your own life first, you young hooligan, you.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Kendrick, talk a little bit about how your first steps into academia and the trouble you got into.
Well, before I got into academia, I was not the world's greatest student. I was one of these kids who was, I was a good student in grammar school. Then I got thrown out of two high schools, and I was almost thrown out of a third high school. Then I wasn't going to go to college, went to a community college, and was almost thrown out of that. But, you know, something happened, and things turned around. And I think in the long run, I became a social psychologist. So social psychologists study the sorts of, you know, issues that most of us think about,
you know,
in everyday life and the kinds of problems we run into. So in some sense, it kind of worked out for me so that I had, you know, I didn't just have a kind of a clean history of hanging around in the library.
No.
I had actually been out there and, you know, I come from a family where there was quite a bit of trouble. Father went to Sing Sing. My brother went to Sing Sing. My uncle went to Sing Sing. Some people might have thought that I was on the same track myself as a teenager. And then I had a stepfather, and we used to not always get along with one another. Looking back on it now, I think it was probably my fault. But you know how it is when you're a teenager.
Well, that's interesting.
But I remember
you punched his lights out. What? You punched his lights out one night, didn't you?
Yeah, I had one of these interesting evenings where you know, he was the guy. He used to like to threaten my brother and I with guns, and you know, we'd fought a lot during my teenage years, and one night he was coming at me, going for his gun rack, and I took a swing at him. It was like in the movies, you know. It never really happens in real life, but you know, it sort of knocked him across the room. He fell on the floor, knocked out cold, and my brother looks at him, looks at the gun rack, and says, should we kill him? And I had to kind of think for a minute and thought, yeah, well, probably not. We split out of there so that we didn't end up getting killed. But so 20 years later, when I'm a professor, I was sitting around with a bunch of colleagues and was talking about homicidal fantasies. And I had the assumption that, well, everybody occasionally thinks about killing somebody else. And most of us don't do anything about it. But I had a couple of colleagues who said, well, they had never, ever, once in their lives thought about killing someone else. So I went out with a guy who was a graduate student at that time, Virgil Sheets, who's now at Indiana State. And we started asking students in our classes, have you ever thought about killing somebody? We tried to remove the stigma from it by saying, you know, lots of people have violent thoughts, and sometimes they range from just hitting somebody to shoving someone to yelling at them to sometimes killing them. And then we asked them, you know, when was the last time you thought of killing someone? Now, some of them said, of course, well, there was no last time. I never thought of killing someone. So we said, in that case, just tell us about the most violent thing you've thought of. But the thing that was surprising to us is that, you know, the majority of men, it was something like three-quarters of the men, had actually had at least one homicidal fantasy, and some of them had them quite frequently, and some of them had them, you know, that morning on the way into classes.
In traffic.
Right, exactly. Yeah. About a total stranger. In fact, it's one of the things that was kind of shocking is that a lot of men's homicidal fantasies involve someone that they've never met and will never see again.
Right. But the women?
Women, surprisingly, I expected women. I mean, if you look at actual homicide rates, it's 90% in the U.S. It's above 90% of the homicides are committed by men, usually against other men, and that turns out to be true all around the world. That there's in a few societies where the homicide rates are very low, you have the women are at 20% instead of 10%. That's about as high as it ever goes, and it's just. A couple of researchers in Ontario, Martin Daly and Margot Wilson, collected some data. Actually, collected it from Detroit crime statistics. But then they went around and they started looking all around the world. They got data on homicides from Oxford, England, in the 1400s. They got data from South American societies. They got data from Asia. It was the same everywhere. Almost all of the homicides are committed by men. But so I expected to see, well, female homicidal fantasies are going to be fairly low. But actually, it was more like 60% of women had at least thought once of killing another person.
When they thought of killing another person, did they think of killing a man or another woman?
Women were also, like men, more likely to think of killing a man.
Hmm.
We piss a lot more people off.
Well, then let me take you back. Again, we're talking with Dr. Douglas Kenrig, who's now a professor of psychology at Arizona State University. But before he got there, had somewhat of a troubled teenage youth. And then on top of that, had kind of a family history of violence and of people who were incarcerated. So you're standing there that night. Your stepfather is coming at you. You land that perfect William Shatner TV punch, and you knock the guy out cold, lands on the floor underneath the family gun rack. And your brother comes up to you and says, should we kill him? You think about it for a minute before you say no. What were the factors that went through your head before you said no?
You know, it's a long time ago, so I don't remember. My guess is they weren't necessarily deeply thought out. They were probably, it's not in our interest to do this.
Right.
We were not getting along with him, and he'd just been threatening our life. And there were times when, you know, to us, now, the guy, of course, did a lot of nice things for both my brother and I as we were growing up. But, you know, he used to drink and threaten our lives. And there were times when, to us, you know, he was like Osama bin Laden. You know,
right.
He was like
terrorist.
The enemy.
Right.
And there's a problem, and there's an interesting problem of families, you know, where there is divorce. I mean, most divorced families, you know, they get along fine. But there is the probability of extreme violence goes up when there are, you know, one of the things we found is we asked people, have you ever thought of killing your father or any other relative. And, you know, some percentage of people had thought of killing their biological father, but like twice as many had thought of killing their stepfather. And what's interesting about that is that the number of years that people spent with their stepfather was typically much lower than the number of years they'd spent with their biological father. So there'd been a lot more time on the clock, and possibly a lot of conflict. Biological fathers have conflict with their children as well. But the probability of thinking of killing the person is higher when it's the stepfather, and it probably goes in both directions. I mean, a kid, from an evolutionary perspective, there's a problem investing. You know, we're designed by nature, like all animals, to care about our offspring. You know, it's like the grizzly bear female up in Yellowstone National Park. When she has a cub nearby, you don't want to go near her. And we've inherited some of that same proclivity. We're very protective of our offspring. We care an awful lot about them. We invest immense amounts in them. But when it comes to having a stepchild, well, we don't have that same biological investment in a stepchild. And so, oddly enough, you know, people don't necessarily understand that. I mean, my brother and I think part of the reason we didn't get along with our stepfather is we were kind of, you know, expecting a lot more of him. And, you know, we'd make demands on him as if he was our biological father, instead of thinking to ourselves, hey, this guy's doing us a favor. You know, he's feeding us.
Right.
And maybe we should give him a little bit more respect.
A break. Yeah. And he's taking care of our mother.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, they didn't get along so well.
Oh, they didn't get along so well. I'll never mind that.
That was the part that got us going most of the time.
Okay.
Families. So,
but then there was another interest of yours, again, of the young pre-doctoral Douglas Kenrick, and that was your fascination with girls. Typical, healthy, teenage boy fascination with girls, right?
Yes.
Okay.
I didn't get the last part of that question. I just switched the phone. I'm here. Your volume's a little low on my phone. I wonder if you guys can turn it up slightly.
I'll see what they can do. I said typical, healthy, teenage obsession with girls. And so the emphasis there being on it was healthy, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, right. It's normal.
Right.
And certainly it was one of those things that as a young guy, I didn't understand too well. And I'm not sure I understand it all that perfectly well now, but I've done a couple of decades of research on questions like what are the criteria that men and women use in choosing mates. And and of course, as we know now, we didn't necessarily know it that well 20, 30 years ago when I started out in this field, but there's gigantic sex differences in the way men and women think when they're thinking about their romantic relationships with the opposite sex. But one of the ones, back to the whole notion of kind of puzzling personal experiences that led to later research, when I first went to graduate school, I was in clinical psychology and not in social psychology. And I had a friend who worked as an applied psychologist. And he and I were sitting around one day by the pool. And I went to graduate school at Arizona State, which is where I am now. And as a kid from New York moving out west, the thing that was shocking was all of the beautiful women. And I remember making a comment to him once, and this is a comment that guys typically made when they came to places like, you know, ASU or UCLA.
A lot of bikini-clad women walking around.
Right, like, wow. My friend, who was also from New York, and he was a decent-looking guy, but he didn't look like a movie actor or anything, and he often was looking for a date on Saturday night. But I remember him saying, yeah, there were really no good-looking women around here. And I thought, wow, that's, did he grow up in, New York's garment district or the fashion district or something? And no, he grew up in Queens, just like I had. But he had a party one night, and it turns out that his wall, which he would show off to us, he had literally wallpapered his wall with Playboy centerfolds. And so I looked at that and I thought, I wonder if there's something going on that this guy's standards for a woman are getting, distorted by this exposure to all, you know, to these incredibly beautiful naked women all the time, so that he sees a good-looking woman, he thinks, no, she's average. He sees an average-looking woman, and he thinks, yeah, she's below average. And of course, as an average-looking guy, that's all that he and most other guys have to choose from. So we started doing some research where we'd actually bring people into the lab and show them beautiful faces, or, you know, we'd show them handsome men, and, you know, then ask them to judge an average man, beautiful women, judge an average woman, show them unattractive people and have them judge an average-looking person. And we got what's called a contrast effect. This is one of these things that if you ever took intro psych, they've got a little demonstration where you put one hand in a bucket of ice water and you put your other hand in a bucket of really hot water. And you take them both out and you plunge them into a bucket of lukewarm water. And what happens is your brain gets these conflicting messages. The hand that was in the ice water is sending a message saying, this lukewarm water is really hot. The hand that was in the hot water is sending a message saying, this is chilly water. And that's called a contrast effect. And it seems to work at all levels. So that if you're looking at a bunch of beauty, or whatever beauty mechanism in your brain seems to tire out, and you come to see, you know, beauty as less. It's a similar sort of thing if you were eating a bunch of really delicious chocolate. Are the receptors for sweetness and fat would get tired, and the next piece of really tasty chocolate wouldn't taste so good.
So the point you make is that Playboy ruins everything. That if you get acclimated to the perfect Playboy body, then no actual living woman would look good enough.
Yeah, she'd look, well, average at best if she had that kind of, you know, if she was 24 years old and highly athletic and in that kind of shape and very healthy, you know, and had attractive parents, she'd look average to you if your wallpaper was Playboy centerfolds.
Right.
And so, you know, I think over the years, I stopped looking at Playboy centerfolds, you know, for that very reason, because it is sort of a spoiler for real life.
Okay, a spoiler. The most romantic notion if you said that to a real person. You know, it's not the most romantic notion if you said that to a woman. You know, I stopped looking at Playboy so that you'd look good.
Right, yes.
I don't know. I wouldn't use that line.
Yes, well, if you stop looking at Playboy, then it'll happen naturally, and
yes,
you will actually look good.
Okay, but I understand that. I just wouldn't go there. I'm
exactly.
Just saying.
You wouldn't want to.
That's not going to help.
Present it to your wife.
It's not going to help your cause.
In those terms, yeah.
Okay, so sex, murder, and the meaning of life. So we're kind of laying the groundwork here for Douglas Kenrick. When we get to this next part here, though, I think this is really important that you, like you said, you had flashes early on of a murderous thought now and then. You also then did some research on it and found out that these were pretty common. And you're doing research on sex and how we look at the opposite sex and how our views can become skewed. So, I mean, a lot of research goes down along this line, right? We say, well, there's something really healthy about having fantasies, be they sexual or violent. We play out the things that we want to do or the things that are haunting us in our brains. We play those out in our minds, and so that's good for us. And that's normal and it's healthy. Where are you with that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would basically say that in terms of, let's think about the notion of, say, homicidal fantasies, that it's healthy to sort of play them out in your minds. I haven't done this research, but other psychologists have done quite a bit of research on it, and it doesn't support that idea. There used to be an old theory called the catharsis theory. It's like, well,
right,
just let it go, let it out, let the anger out, you know, and think about it or whatever, or yell at someone. And it turns out that it doesn't really work all that well. It turns out that if you want to avoid conflict in your life, you're better kind of stopping violent thoughts and aggressive thoughts and learning some alternative ways of, you know, saying, defusing an aggressive situation and learning how to defuse aggressive situations rather than kind of bathing in it.
All right. Well, hang on to that, because then we'll get back to then what does this say then about our the baser instincts in our brain that despite the fact that that would be the better alternative for that, we still don't do it. And so we'll get to sex, murder, and the meaning of life. Douglas Kenrick continues next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. That song, Murder by Numbers, reminds me of our first hour with Glennis McCants. We were talking about the numerology of people involved in scandals. If you follow a certain pattern, people that had previously sterling reputations or were known for being, you know, strong political voices, and then suddenly, boom, caught. And we find out a whole part of their past, which you may not have suspected, that it follows a certain numerological significance that defies coincidence. So says Glennis McCants. You can go back and catch that in the first hour. If you have Coast Insider, you can always sign up for that at coasttocoastam.com. In fact, I was looking for a show back in 2009, and it just, boom, all of these shows, all of these great archive shows are waiting for you if you're a Coast Insider. So you can always enjoy not just what you're hearing nightly on the radio, but also in your spare time, you know, download a podcast from a couple of years ago. If you like one particular guest, go back and listen to the other time that they're on. And you can do that with Coast Insider. Find out more at coasttocoastam.com. Pretty inexpensive, and you get a lot for your money. And you're going to get a lot coming up next. We'll talk more about murder that's in the brain, the part of us that craves these violent fantasies, and how murder and sex will, when we fully understand them, will make us seem a lot more like howling hyenas than like the evolved human beings we like to think of ourselves. Next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Well, Dr. Douglas Kenrick is one of the founding fathers of what we call evolutionary psychology. Social psychology is also something that he's written about extensively in the past. And there is a selfish, animalistic underside of human nature, which we're exploring in Sex, Murder, and the Meaning of Life. Haven't we always known that to be true? I mean, doesn't the very nature of the Bible address this animalistic underside that we are coming to terms with?
Well, yeah, we certainly, people have always had a sense of it, but one of the things that is surprising is that when I got into this field a few decades ago, people were kind of in a big state of denial about this. The prevailing view was actually of the mind as a blank slate. And now, if you talk to most psychologists or sociologists or biologists, they'll deny that they ever believed that, but they did. But the viewpoint was, well, in fact, you still get this in certain fields, like in business. Some of my former students who are now professors at business colleges run into these reviewers who make the argument, well, humans, we have this big brain, and we're therefore exempt from the principles of evolution, and well, we can rise above all that, you know, and certainly we can try to rise above all that, but to have a scientific view that says that, well, for example, the sex differences between men and women in terms of their mating strategies, they were explained as just something, used to be explained as in terms of American culture, and that was stated quite seriously if you looked at the literature a couple of decades ago. And how we ever came to believe that, it's kind of hard to know. But what it turns out is that a lot of the things that we perceive to be true in American culture, so for example, men are more interested in one-night stands than women, that turns out to be a universal kind of phenomenon. In fact, it's not only just universal in our species, it's universal across most, it's almost universal in mammals. It's actually a little less so in human beings than it is in most other mammals. Most other mammals, 90% of other mammalian species, the male contributes only sperm. It's all one-night stands. You know, it's all like Los Angeles in 1972 or something along those lines.
Right. So the thought is that the strategies are different than how men, if we're to look at it biologically, are more inclined to just look for one-night stands, to be mating wherever they could, what are the typical female mating strategies?
So now let me just say that men, as I was beginning to say a second ago, humans are a little bit different in the sense of it's not all one-night stands with humans. In fact, human beings, most mating occurs in the context of long-term, more or less, monogamous relationships, not usually, you know, not always completely monogamous, but more or less, you know, long-term pair bonded relationships. And that makes us in the small 10% of the mammalian species. And why do we hang? Why do males hang around? Well, probably because there's been some sort of co-evolutionary process. We have very, very big-brained, very helpless offspring, and often, if the male doesn't hang around or during ancestral times, and there's even some studies that have been done of hunter-gatherer cultures during the 20th century, if the father's not there, the kids are much more likely not to survive. And so, fathers hanging around facilitated the young surviving. And so, human beings are different, but we're not completely, even though we have that tendency to pair bond, which makes us a little bit in a minority amongst mammals, more like birds in many ways. But there is still a temptation for infidelity, which is different for men and for women. The costs and the benefits from a biological perspective are very different for men and women because of what they call obligatory parental investment, which sounds like a big term, but it really just refers to something that I think we can all intuitively understand, which is that for a female, the obligatory, the minimum cost is very high. You know, if you think of going into restaurants, if you were going to spend $200 for dinner tonight, you'd read the reviews before you went. You'd be very careful about picking that really fancy restaurant that you were going to go to. And, you know, if you were going to go spend money like at the French Laundry, you'd look carefully before you decided to write that check. But if you're going to spend $5 for fast food, you're not going to be as discriminating. And so when it comes to mating, males have the option to eat the $5 fast food meal. Females don't. Females always pay. It's always the French Laundry when you're a female. You're always paying a high price, carrying the child inside your body for 9 months, then nursing it afterwards, and then in human beings spending, you know, maybe 15, 20, 25 years contributing resources to those children. So females always pay a high price. So they're discriminating, careful customers. If males have the opportunity for, you know, a fast copulatory option, they'll take it. I mean, we keep seeing it. It comes up in the news all the time. Tiger Woods, you know, Wiener this week. Right. But it's, you know, every week it's a new guy who gets caught taking advantage of these casual mating opportunities.
Well, okay, but didn't birth control just change everything? I mean, aren't we? I know I work with a lot of 20-something women, and they don't have that concern, or they don't talk about that concern that way. If there's a guy and they want to hook up, this generation, and you're a professor, you know plenty more people in this age group than I do.
Right.
There just doesn't seem to be this concern of, ooh, if we have sex, I might be looking at 25-year commitment with this kid. I mean, most of the people I know talk about sex much more casually than the men do. And it seems to me like there's a great amount of equality in this current generation when it comes to the casualness of the sex.
Right. I mean, that's an extremely good point. Birth control does change. It changes the biology to a large extent. I mean, females still eventually get pregnant. Sometimes the birth control doesn't work. But on average, if a female is taking birth control, okay, or, you know, if people are using condoms, the probability of pregnancy can go to, you know, to close to zero. But even during the peak of the sexual revolution in the 1960s and 70s and 80s, when birth control was made available, you still have, I mean, females inherited a brain from our ancestors that was around for a very long time. And is still programmed to be more careful, to have sort of an emotional response to the possibility of a one-night stand that isn't the same as men. Now there are different mating strategies, there actually is a lot of research that looks at what's the probability that you'd be willing to, say, have a one-night stand. And of course, men would never have one-night stands if there weren't some women that were willing to have one-night stands. But it turns out that there are about, in terms of people that have what we call an unrestricted mating strategy, there's at least twice as many men that are willing to go for that. And there's studies that have been done, again, during the peak of the sexual revolution, a lot of these studies were done. You know, have you ever had an affair? And men have somewhat more affairs than women. And people used to wonder, well, why is it? Partially it's because men have affairs with younger women who are not yet married. If you have had an affair, some percentage of married women have certainly had affairs. And then you ask, do you think you're going to do that again? Men in these studies were something like 10 times more likely to say yes, whereas the women were no. You know, they don't have the same emotional response in general. Again, there are differences. There are some men that are much more monogamous than some women. It's just that the numbers work out so that men are much more likely to be careless. I mean, a classic study that was done, and this was done, it was done in the 60s, then it was done again in the 80s. This was even after AIDS and certainly after birth control. Some researchers went up, it's kind of a well-known study, you might have heard about it. They walked up this to, they had an attractive undergraduate assistant who would walk up to someone on campus just cold and say, excuse me, I've seen you around, I find you attractive, would you like to go on a date with me? That was one condition. Another condition was, excuse me, I've seen you around, I find you attractive, would you like to go up to my room with me? And then the final condition was, excuse me, I've seen you around, I find you attractive, would you like to go to bed with me? Well, what they found, and they found the same thing, you know, in the 80s as they'd found back in the 60s, and I think people have replicated it again. I'll tell you about a little qualification on that in just a second, but what they found is that about 50% of the women and 50% of the men said yes to a stranger walking up to them asking for a date. Now, this is another college student. It's someone who's pretty attractive. Now, what about would you go to my room? Well, now, I think it's something like 5% of the women said yes to that, and, you know, something like 60% of the men. Would you go to bed with me tonight? 73% of the men said yes to that. These are men who wouldn't go on a date with this woman. They did say, yes, I'd go to bed. For the women, they found no one saying yes. And they did it twice across two decades, got the exact same results.
With a really handsome guy walking up to a woman and saying, would you like to go to bed with me?
I'm not sure the guy was really handsome. He was attractive.
He was attractive. But I'm just saying, so he wasn't a troll.
He was a bad-looking guy.
Right. And so that he, in doing that, though, it was 0% of the women said.
No women said yes to that. No. To a stranger walking up to him. Now, some women have said.
Not where I work.
Yeah.
Not other women around my cafeteria table. I can tell you that.
Yeah.
But.
Well, one of the things that's interesting. Well, some people have said, oh, gee, the women are. They were worried about the, you know, rape, or they were scared of the guy. But remember, 50% of them said yes, they go on a date with him. They're willing to get alone with the guy.
They're willing to drive with him somewhere. They're just not willing to say yes to that.
I'm going to go to bed with you tonight.
Now, I know you've got more on that, but let me just ask you, how many of the women say yes to the date, but they're thinking sex? And they say yes to date, but when they actually, you know, when you actually press them on the sex part, they'll say no. But if they really had to be honest, they were saying yes to the date, thinking it would lead to sex.
Right. I mean, typically, so people have done research where David Buss at the University of Texas, for example, has done some study looking at, ideally, this is just, now we're on paper. This isn't a real stranger walking up to you on campus. Ideally, how long do you think you'd want to be dating someone before you would be willing to sleep with them? Okay, and this is in the abstract. And this is someone you imagine someone that you've picked that you find attractive. You know, for women, it was in the range of, you know, a month or 2 months or something. For men, it was, is she willing to sleep with me? You know, like 2 minutes would be fine. Okay. So even just imagining these things, women are more interested in getting into a romantic relationship with the guy. It isn't that women, obviously, we're all here because women have sex, okay? There's no reproduction without females being interested in reproducing. But for females, they want to reproduce on average with someone who they are in love with, who they think has a lot going for them, and they want to get to know the guy first. They want to know that this guy is someone who's reliable, who's reasonable. Now, again, there's some qualifications on this, and this is some fascinating stuff that's come up in the last few years. When women are ovulating, okay, so
right.
during the period of time...
All bets are off.
All bets aren't completely off.
Well, but it changes everything.
They get more careful when they're ovulating.
Right.
But if a woman is married or in a long-term relationship with a guy, and a guy comes along who is more attractive than her current partner, she is interested. She'll fantasize about having sex with him. And in fact, when women have affairs, the guys are often more attractive than the guy that they're involved in a long-term relationship with, and they're more likely to have sex with them on the nights they're ovulating.
Right.
Suggesting that they're in some ways females are programmed for this strategy. If you're gonna run around, pick a guy. Biologists say it's a guy that has good genes. So it isn't that women, again,
right.
you know, women
well,
aren't not interested in mating, and women aren't innocent of all sensual motivations or even kind of nefarious.
Sure.
Motives in this game. It's just they're playing a different game. The payoffs are different for females than for males.
You know, this came up in regard to the brawny paper towel guy. Do you remember this?
Did you ever hear about this? No.
Okay. So there used to be the original brawny paper towel image was of this kind of Paul Bunyan-esque kind of guy, right?
Right. Okay. That guy. Yeah.
Then they switched it to a more kind of refined, not a woodsman, but kind of an outdoorsman type, you know,
right.
kind of a woodsy type, but not at all like, you know, it's just more of an REI kind
of
guy,
exactly.
right? And then they found, I think that they found that when they did test research on this, that women really responded to a guy with a little more stubble, and they really wanted more of the original brawny kind of dangerous brawny.
They wanted the big macho guy, right?
Right, and I think that and one of the things they've said too is that during I've seen research about the ovulating period in dance clubs, that if the right guy who's not as good looking hooks up with the right woman who's ovulating, he stands a better chance than a better looking guy with a woman who's at a different place in her cycle. That you could actually calculate the odds out for that.
Okay, I haven't heard that, but I do know that, yeah, there is all kinds of stuff that is looked at. There's some researchers in Germany who've looked at how women dress when they go to a nightclub, and there's a lot more skin showing when a woman is ovulating.
Right.
And when guys look at women who are ovulating, oddly enough, can't tell. Often women can't tell when they're ovulating, but they have guys rate photographs of women who are ovulating. They look more attractive.
How about that?
Yeah.
Now, did you see the recent finch study, the zebra finch study?
I did not see it, no.
Okay. So, yeah, I know I'm throwing a lot at you here, so thanks for staying with me. So just earlier this week, researchers in Australia, I believe, did a study of 1,500 banded zebra finches.
Okay.
Which are known for being... monogamous birds.
Uh-huh.
And what they found was, I just thought this was fascinating, is that there's always going to be a percentage of male zebra finches who will take advantage of a sexual opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And what they found was the male zebra finches who reproduced outside of their monogamous relationship
mm-hmm.
created more zebra finches where the females were more likely to be quote-unquote promiscuous.
Ah, interesting.
It was kind of a twist. I wasn't expecting that the female zebra finches that were offsprings of a promiscuous male were more inclined to have to struggle with monogamy later
right.
on in their finchy adulthood. I'd love to have you reflect on that if you would for... You're also in the research in sex, murder, and the meaning of life. Douglas Kendrick explaining how our brains work. And then We'll get a little bit more into the murder side of things. And how is it that we are much more like howling hyenas than the evolved human beings we like to think of ourselves as being? Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Bonnet.